The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show with me, Charles Christian, as once more we delve into the worlds of weirdness, urban myths, arcane history, geek culture, ghosts, magic, witchcraft, the occult, and anything else I think will intrigue you. This week's guest is Peter Muse, who has been exploring New England legends, folklore, and weird traditions for 20 years. He's a writer and blogger, and his most recent book, out this month, is Witches and Warlocks of Massachusetts. Peter has also appeared as a guest expert on the Travel Channel's Mysteries at the Museum. Not surprisingly, we're talking about the folklore and legends of New England. Well, let's start at the beginning. What got you interested in the folklore of New England?
That's a good question. This is what I tell people, so you're going to hear my standard. This is how I got into the weird stuff story.
Yeah.
I grew up in the 1970s, mm-hmm. and in the 1970s, there was a lot of sort of paranormal phenomena starting to appear in the media. So there, you know, shows about Bigfoot, movies about Bigfoot, movies about the Bermuda Triangle, more attention being paid to UFOs, things like that. Even the local papers would have articles about like Bigfoot being mm-hmm. seen someplace in Massachusetts. Even if it was a hoax, right? These things would sort of show up.
Yeah.
And so that was one stream. Like I sort of was interested in that. And I had an older brother who was really into a lot of that as well. So I kind of absorbed some of that from him. On the other hand, I was also the type of kid who was really into mythology and legends and things like that. So, you know, I had lots of books about Greek mythology, Norse mythology, the Arabian Nights, sort of those sorts of books.
Yeah.
So that was another stream, right? And those two streams. I went to college. I got a couple degrees in anthropology and was studying more like folklore mythology from around the world. Really only it was when I got out of college and had been out for a few years that I realized I didn't really know that much about the region where I had lived my whole life, right? I didn't know that much about the folklore and the legends of Massachusetts or New England, which is the general region.
Yeah.
So I started to sort of think, well, let me see what there is to learn here. And I just started to read and research, and it's never stopped. I mean, it's been probably close to 20 years now, and there's just always more to find. Because I think both are always new things coming up sort of in the paranormal contemporary field, right? Whatever you call that, whether it's modern folklore, whether it's something else. At the same time, I'm also looking backwards and finding all this other folklore, all these other legends from the last like 400 years or so. So the two combined have just filled up my brain with a lot of interesting information, I'll say, right?
Lovely. Yeah, just looking at the things you've written about in your books, one of them, we don't really need to go into detail, but just for the benefit of non-American listeners, you've got one on the legends and lore of the North Shore. Where's the North Shore then in?
The North Shore is it's part of Massachusetts. It's sort of the coastal region north of Boston and up to the New Hampshire border. So it's kind of the part of the state along the ocean from Boston up to New Hampshire. And
right.
So that's a relatively old part of the state. Like Salem, Massachusetts is there. That was founded in like 1626, I think. So the towns up there are, that's old for America, right? That's
yes.
not old for England. It's old for America. And so, and they're founded by Puritans who kind of came over here from East Anglia. And, you know, they want to set up a Puritan theocracy. and, you know, the rest is history. Salem witch trials ensue, things like that.
I'm actually in East Anglia, and the church just about 3 miles down the road was originally attended by the family of a couple of the pilgrims, the original ones there. And there's still some of their ancestors and collateral buried there. But it's a fascinating area, that. Now, obviously, the Salem witch trials feature heavily in anything to do with this, but possibly I think it might be interesting for people to hear about post-Salem witch trials. You know, it's such a well-known story. And,
sure.
You know, what happened, you know, the Salem witch trials ended, and then some years later in the early years of the 1700s, wasn't it, there were various legal proceedings and people admitting they'd made up stories and so on.
Yes, definitely. So the Salem witch trials technically were the last witchcraft trials in Massachusetts. I think the Puritans kind of realized, much too late, that you can't prove the existence of witchcraft or the devil in court, right? People generally agreed after the Salem witch trials ended that it was a political and social disaster, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people's reputations were ruined who had been behind it and things like that. But they did not stop believing in witchcraft and the devil. Those two things still remain strong. And so you do see, after the Salem witch trials, there is still like strong belief in witchcraft. And you see people practicing defensive magic against witchcraft, but you don't see the trials. There were a few times where there was almost a trial. And I think you were talking maybe about, I want to say it's 1720 in Littleton, Massachusetts, which is a sort of a rural town. These three young girls, I believe it was the Blanchard family, these three young girls all started to exhibit, you know, classic symptoms of being bewitched. And often they would find themselves, these girls would be discovered in situations where they're almost going to, you know, be killed. Like, oh, you know, the littlest girl is up on the roof of the house. Look, she's going to fall off. And then people come and rescue her. And she's like, oh, a witch put me up on the top of the house. Or another one's found, you know, in the middle of the pond, floundering around like she's going to drown. She's like, oh, somebody saved me. A witch put me in the pond, and I don't know how I got here. So they were constantly being saved from danger, which they said was being caused by the witch. And in addition to that, they also, you know, showed some of the classic witch symptoms like, you know, contortions, pain, seeing strange visions, things like that. And so the people in Littleton questioned these girls and said, you know, who's causing this? Witchcraft doesn't just happen. Someone is causing this to happen to you. And the girls were asked this several times. And finally, the oldest girl said, it's this woman down the road. It's Abigail Dudley. And Abigail Dudley was one of the earliest settlers in the town. She was the mother of 12 children, and she was sort of a respected member of the community. And people were, you know, on the fence, like, should we, you know, accuse her formally of witchcraft? Should we put her on trial or not? But Abigail Dudley sort of avoided the whole question. She died in childbirth, giving birth to her 13th child. And so the whole thing just sort of fizzled out.
Yeah.
But then 8 years later, the oldest of the Blanchard girls moved to another town, and she was at church. And the minister was preaching about, you know, how God doesn't let liars into heaven and liars go straight to hell, et cetera, et cetera. And this Blanchard girl started to cry, and she confessed to the minister that she had made the whole thing up. Her sisters had made the whole thing up. They did it just for attention. And then when they were pressured by other people in the town to name a witch, they had to name somebody, so they just chose the first person who came to mind, who was Abigail Dudley. And you can see how the whole thing could have gone really, really poorly.
Yeah.
But Abigail Dudley, I mean, it's terrible that she died in childbirth, but if she had lived, she would have ended up being accused of witchcraft and maybe being executed. So it was this narrowly avoided situation. And it was written about by several political people at the time after it was revealed that this is what had happened. They're like, oh, look at this, you know. So there was sort of this skepticism about the ability to prove witchcraft in court, but I think there was still plenty of belief about witchcraft. Even as late as, I have a couple late ones. 1843, there was a man in Pepperell, Massachusetts, a man named Absalom Lawrence. He lived in a big farmhouse with his family, and he noticed, and his family noticed, some strange phenomena in the house, like doors slamming open and shut, pots and pans rattling. Sometimes they would hear groaning voices coming from the basement, and there was nobody in the basement. You know, big footsteps. Yeah. And at first he thought, oh, you know, my house, it's haunted. This is a ghost. And it sounds a lot like modern poltergeist activity. But yeah. Then his daughter, his oldest daughter, started to exhibit the classic witchcraft symptoms, contortions. Her jaw would lock. Her tongue would stick out. People are, you know, unseen people sticking pins in her body, maybe barking like a dog, like all those classic witchcraft
symptoms. Yeah, yeah.
So Absalom Lawrence is like, okay, my daughter is bewitched. It's 1843 by this point. So Massachusetts is industrializing. It's sort of an educational capital of the area. No one is going to have a witch trial in 1843. And so what he does, which is really interesting, he looks through the newspaper and he finds an ad for a wandering animal magnetizer, which is basically like a wandering hypnotist, which was sort of a new kind of pseudoscience at the time. And so he hires this wandering animal magnetizer or hypnotist to come to his house. And the hypnotist brings with him his young, attractive female assistant, because I guess that's what hypnotists always have. And right, at least in the media. And the hypnotist puts his assistant in a trance. In the trance, the assistant says, I can see an old woman with long hair coming to this house on a horse that has no horseshoes on it, which is a significant detail because witches are allergic to horseshoes, right? You put a horseshoe up over the door to keep a witch out. Mm-hmm. And then the assistant says, I can see the old woman. She comes in through the keyhole. She slips under the crack through the door. She slips through the window pane. There is a witch who is assaulting this family, which is really pretty freaky. The animal magnetizer, or the hypnotist, whatever you want to call him, then somehow uses his hypnotic powers to expel the witch from the house. And as he does this, they hear this hideous groaning and heavy footsteps like tromping out the front door. And the hypnotist says, you know, I've used my animal magnetism to expel the witch. You are safe now. Which sounds like it should be a happy ending. But if, you know, after a while, the symptoms return. The house is once again is racked by these strange phenomena. And it only ends when Absalom Lawrence and his family move to southern New Hampshire, which is nearby. And so that's how it ends with that. But that's 1843, which is quite pretty late, right?
Yeah.
There's even one account from, I want to say it's 1926, in Chelsea, Massachusetts, which is a dense urban industrial city. Chelsea, Massachusetts is not a rural folk horror type of town. Like, it is right next to Boston. It's on a river. It's a big industrial town.
Yeah.
And in 1926, a man in Chelsea, an adult man in Chelsea, again, showing the classic witchcraft symptoms, his body is contorted, he's in a lot of pain, all of this sort of stuff. And his family brings in a doctor, a physician, and the doctor looks at him and thinks, oh, you know, maybe he's got some stomach problems, but maybe this is just a psychological disorder or something like that. Mm-hmm. The family takes this in. They're like, no, we think you're wrong. We need a second opinion. And so they bring in what they call a witch doctor, which, to clarify, like, I think witch doctor in a lot of people's imagination is drawn from like Hollywood movies, like someone with shrunken heads in a big boiling pot, who wants to cook you. That's not the original meaning of the term. And in this case, they're like, if you have a problem with your eyes, you bring in an eye doctor. You have problems with your ear, you bring in an ear doctor. You have problems with a witch, you bring in the witch doctor.
Yeah.
So the family brings in this witch doctor. And, of course, since he's a witch doctor, he looks at the guy and says, oh, of course, he's bewitched. I can cure him. I need to make a potion out of 9 ingredients. And, unfortunately, the only ingredient that we have record of is that he needed to use graveyard grass, so grass growing from a graveyard. He makes this potion. He brings it to the family. They give it to the man who's afflicted, and it cures him, and that is that. But that's 1926, so that's pretty late. You know, that's not 1692. That's a big difference. And so there was still this witchcraft belief out there. And even 1929, a woman who lived in Boston wrote to the horror writer H.P. Lovecraft, who lived just south in Rhode Island. And she's like, you know, H.P. Lovecraft, I enjoy reading your stories. It is clear you have access to true occult knowledge. I am a descendant of a Salem witch, and I'm a witch myself, and I will share my witchcraft secrets with you if you share your occult secrets with me. And they corresponded for a while, and, you know, Lovecraft was a big skeptic. He didn't believe in witchcraft or magic, but he wanted to see what sort of weird stories or weird tales he could get from this elderly woman that he might be able to incorporate into his fiction. And unfortunately, she died, and I don't believe he ever identified her by name. Like, I would love to look through his archives and find out if in any of his letters he mentions her by name, just to see who she was, right? Who in 1929 was calling themselves a witch? Right, and trying to get more occult knowledge for herself. So it's interesting. It continues on, I guess.
One of the other elements that I think surprises a lot of people is that New England also has a fairy folklore tradition, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And I think partly it's surprising to people because the witchcraft is so predominant, the witchcraft lore. And a lot of that is because my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, since you live in that area, but, you know, that the East Anglian Puritans who came here brought witchcraft lore, they brought ghost lore, they brought a lot of belief about the devil. They didn't bring a lot of fairy lore. And it's my understanding there's not as much fairy lore in East Anglia as there might be in other places.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair, whereas places like Cornwall in the southwest and the Isle of Man in the northwest and things, they have a big fairy type, and obviously the Scottish borders as well. All of them have a tradition. And yeah, we don't have many fairies as such in this part of the world at all.
And so the Puritans who came here from that area brought that mindset with them. And you even, you know, some writers, like in the early 1800s, are all saying, oh, there are no fairies in New England. No fairies in New England. People like Nathaniel Hawthorne, like, there are no fairies in New England at all. And there's an interesting case from the 1800s, probably the mid-1800s, where an innkeeper in southern New Hampshire, he ran this kind of ramshackle inn that nobody really liked to go to. He was supposedly very surly. His wife was Irish. At a certain point, they said, oh, you know what? Fairies have moved into our inn. They've infested our inn. And if you come and hang out in our pub room, you'll be able to hear the fairies. So people would come to this inn, and they would sit, and they would listen. They would hear these high-pitched voices talking. And I'm not sure exactly what they said, but they would hear these high-pitched voices talking. They couldn't see any fairies, but they could hear them talking. Mm-hmm. And one commentator says they kind of spoke a bastardized blend of New England Yankee dialect and Irish dialect. Mm-hmm. And you would hear this high-pitched voices. So the business at the inn really picked up once this happened, once the fairies showed up. And you might be able to see where this is going. And it was all going great for the innkeeper until a couple of people from Massachusetts came, and they were just very skeptical. And they were, you know, as everyone was sitting in the pub room listening to the fairies, they decided to sneak upstairs and see what was happening. And they could see that the innkeeper's daughters were up there, crouched over the floor, speaking in these high-pitched voices. And so the whole thing, you know, was a scam, which just further encouraged people to disbelieve that there was fairy lore here, like, that there were no fairies.
Yeah.
Some parts of the – there was one part of the state – one particular town called Marblehead, which sticks out into the ocean on a peninsula. It's really – it's hard to get to even today. Like, it's just a long trip to get there.
Yeah.
It was harder to get to in the past, and it was not settled by Puritans, but it was settled by fishermen from various parts of England, including Cornwall and Devon and all these other areas, I think. And so there was fairy lore there in that one place, and it was one of the first places where the word pixie was actually written down. Being recorded there. So you read stories about people being pixie-led in Marblehead, mm-hmm. and how they have to turn their coats inside out to find their way back home, and you shouldn't go out at night because the fairies will get you and things like that. So there was a tiny bit of kind of European fairies lore, but not a ton.
Yeah.
But what the Puritans generally were ignoring was that you know, there have been Native Americans living here for 13,000 plus years, and they actually had a really rich lore about various magical beings that live, you know, in the woods or under the hills or in the lakes and things like that. The Puritans were not big on recording Native American culture. That was, they were more about exterminating it. It was only sort of in the 19th century that people started to record that Native American lore down, but it's very rich, and you do see a lot of different names for sort of these small, hairy, magical creatures who live in the woods, who some are malevolent, some are benevolent, most are sort of neutral and should be treated with caution and respect. So you can see like the parallels between...
Very similar to sort of European concept of Seely Court and Unseely Court. Yes.
Right. And really, the people now will use the word puckwudgie to talk about these kind of local fairy beings, which actually comes from the Ojibwa language. And the Ojibwa live way out in the northern Midwest of the U.S., but the term was introduced to Massachusetts through the poet Longfellow. He wrote a famous poem in the 19th century, The Song of Hiawatha, which was about Ojibwa culture. And then someone incorporated part of Song of Hiawatha into a town history. And then finally in the 1920s, a folklorist named Elizabeth Renard was talking to some Wampanoag men who lived on Cape Cod. And the Wampanoag are the indigenous tribes of Cape Cod. She's talking to these two men about their folk beliefs, folk stories. And when they told her folk stories about small, magical little people, they used the word puckwudgie. They had sort of taken this Ojibwa term and made it their own. And now it's kind of just used across Massachusetts. So people talk about puckwudgies here. And, you know, they're supposed to be in certain places. You know, Cape Cod, there's a place called the Freetown State Forest, which is an overall locus of weird activity. So there's a certain ledge there where they're supposed to be lurking and causing trouble. And I went to the ledge, and happily I did not see any. I was, you know, lucky enough to, like, avoid that. But so so there's sort of this fairy lore here. And in addition, there are, people have brought over European fairy lore, so it's kind of layered on top of that. You know, you'll sometimes read about people saying, like hearing banshees, if it's an Irish-American family, like a banshee is heard when someone in their family dies. Things like that. Where there's an abandoned fairy village in Connecticut, and it was originally built as like a part of an amusement park. Like a train would go through this amusement park and you'd drive through this little miniature town.
Gotcha, yeah.
It's since been abandoned. It's now just in the woods. And there is this sort of throne-like structure there in the middle of the woods. And supposedly if you sit on the throne, the fairies will come and do you in. Because they don't want you to come and, you know, be spying on their tiny little houses out there in the woods. Which I, again, like, if I went there, I probably would not take the risk. I would not sit on the throne, just in case there was some truth to that story. Right. During the daytime, I'm very skeptical, but if you put me in the woods at night or something, I revert to a more primitive mindset, I would say. Right.
Do you think New England is weirder than other parts of the US? I mean, obviously, we associate it with, well, I do, with H.P. Lovecraft and his geography of the area and all the locations there. But obviously that's fiction. Is it a spookier area or a weirder area, do you think?
That's a good question. I think, in, you know, with H.P. Lovecraft, who is kind of controversial these days a little bit, but he does have his fictional geography, but it's based pretty closely on real geography. So someplace like Innsmouth in his stories, it was actually based on Newburyport, Massachusetts, which now Newburyport is sort of a posh coastal town where tourists go to visit. You know, you walk through their charming, refurbished downtown area, walk out and look at the water. But when he went during the Depression, it was just a real grim place. And someone jokingly called it like City of the Living Dead. It was so run down. Like all the stores are boarded up, the houses are boarded up, everything's falling into ruin. And the houses, some of the houses, they were like 300, 400 years old. And so that really inspired him to create the town of Innsmouth in his stories. But it's interesting that sort of the three most famous American horror writers all came from New England. Edgar Allan Poe was born in Boston. He was raised in Boston. He lived here until he was a young man. And then he left because people here were so uptight. He just couldn't take it anymore. So he went further south where people are more free-spirited, I guess, than they are in Boston. So there's the first one. Then H.P. Lovecraft in Rhode Island. And finally Stephen King from Maine.
So it's interesting
that those three, who are sort of the most influential horror writers, all came from a relatively small part of the U.S. And people have tried to explain that, talk about New England Gothic and things like that. And even in American horror fiction, there's so many stories and novels about people retiring to a small New England town to get away from it all. And then, you know, they discover the horrible, shocking secrets and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in a lot of people's minds, it is the spooky location. Shows like Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, which is just out recently, was set in New England. So you have that idea. And I'm not sure why that is exactly. Part of me thinks it's just because this area is older than other parts of the U.S., you know, in terms of your, you know, Anglo-American culture, it's older. I think, you know, the Puritans came over and they did a lot of good things that, you know, set the tone for the society that's in New England now, but also the witchcraft beliefs, the emphasis on the devil, the emphasis on sin and damnation and guilt that you can't get rid of. I think all that kind of feeds into, it's like in the subconscious of this area. It's just kind of lurking in the background. Like, every, you know, kind of know, like, meh, if you went back a few hundred years ago, things would be a little weirder than they are now. And I think, like, when I often think about those people who came over, it was a, they were from the late Renaissance. They were not, it was not the Enlightenment. So those are folks that could have seen, like, Shakespeare performed live for the first time, right? Oh, we, you know, we saw The Tempest. It was great. This brand new play called The Tempest. And they come to Massachusetts and start executing witches. Yeah, I think that's part of it. And it's an interesting landscape here, too. The it was covered by glaciers during the Ice Age. And when the glaciers retreated, they deposited these giant boulders everywhere. And so you walk through the woods and you just find, like, giant random boulders in strange shapes and giant, you know, boulders piled onto each other, forming caves. And just, it's a weird landscape. And I think the landscape also contributed maybe to the weirdness, because it was really difficult for farmers here. So the, you know, the first settlers, the Puritans, farmed this area. It was not a great place to farm. The soil's acidic. It's very stony. So when regions further west opened up, like in New York or Ohio, a lot of people left this area to go out west where there was better farmland. And then steam locomotives enabled the produce to be brought, you know, into the cities here. But a lot of the small towns became almost ghost towns. And if you walk out in the woods, you will find just empty cellar holes, walls that delineate where farms used to be, but are now long gone. And that sort of influences people like H.P. Lovecraft. This idea that New England is decaying because people have left here, you know, and gone off to other places. And you can find, there's an interesting ghost town in Gloucester, Massachusetts, up on the North Shore, where originally, this was like, I want to say 1720 or so, I'll just say 1720, the civic leaders in Gloucester, which is a coastal town, they needed to open up some new land for more people to live in, because the coastal area right by the harbor was getting too crowded. So they set up this place called the Common Settlement, which is kind of inland and up on this stony plateau. Again, it's like those giant stones. And it wasn't great for farming, but there were a lot of craftsmen who lived up there. So barrel makers, millers, blacksmiths, people like that, and people would raise sheep. But it started to decline. People were called away for the Revolutionary War. And then the church in Gloucester was moved even further. It was moved to a different location. So that was sort of the social and civic center of town. And so it was moved further away from the common settlement. So it sort of became an undesirable backwater. A lot of people left. The buildings slowly started to decay, the houses. And the common settlement got the nickname of Dogtown. supposedly because of the feral dogs that moved in there and just kind of roamed through the streets. But in addition to feral dogs, a lot of elderly women and other social outcasts from Gloucester and other neighboring towns moved into the abandoned buildings. And a lot of them got the reputation of being witches. And some of them actually made money off their reputation as witches. So some of these women made herbal cures like, you know, tea out of bayberry or tonics out of spruce tops or things like that. They would make these herbal cures. Some of them were fortune tellers reading tea leaves, coffee leaves, or palms, reading people's palms. But there were a couple of them who were supposedly very terrifying looking, so they were not traditionally attractive. And they would curse people. And one of them lived, I think her name was Tammy Younger. She lived in this rundown house right on the main road that kind of went through Dogtown into Gloucester proper. And if she heard a wagon coming, or if she heard a horse coming, she would stick her head out the window and she would scream that she was going to curse these people unless they paid her a toll. And people would pay her a toll because everyone was afraid of her.
Yeah.
And apparently when she died, people were still afraid of her. Like, the coffin maker who was making the coffin for her body had the coffin inside his house, which was traditional for him to do. And his family was like, you have to get her coffin out of the house. It's giving off negative energy, whatever the equivalent was of the 1800s. Like, put it out in the barn. We can't have a coffin of that sinister witch in our house. Eventually, Dogtown became completely abandoned. And you can actually go there today. It's sort of like conservation land or a large park. And it's very... it's just totally overgrown. You can see the cellar holes where these witches lived. There are small markers. You can see some of the stone walls that used to exist there. And it's kind of spooky. There was a wealthy industrialist who lived in the town named Roger Babson. He was one of the founding he came from like one of the founding families of Gloucester. Mm-hmm. And in the 1920s, he was like, oh, you know, everyone thinks Dogtown is so spooky, right? Everyone's talking about witches at Dogtown. I want to change the reputation of Dogtown. So being an industrialist, he hired these stonemasons to carve inspirational slogans into the boulders. So there are like 25 or so of these boulders in Dogtown with slogans like, be on time, work hard, think ahead. And the area now is just totally overgrown forest. The terrain is rough. It's rocky. So you'll be wandering through this overgrown forest and suddenly stumble upon this boulder like that just says be on time in the middle of nowhere. And it has the opposite effect.
Yes.
Right. You can sort of see how nature has taken over and Roger Babson's efforts are not paying off here. But
what about some of the other places? I've got some in my notes.
You mean just spooky places or witchy places?
Well, both. Let's start with, seems an obvious one, Witch Rock in Peabody.
Oh, Witch Rock in Peabody. That's an interesting one. So in the 17th century, in the 1600s, Salem was a very large town. It was quite big. And if you go to Salem now, it's much smaller. It's confined pretty much to a coastal town. But it was actually much larger at the time. And several other parts of it broke off to form other towns, like Danvers is one of them. And Peabody also used to be part of Salem. And in the 1970s, some archaeologists were surveying Peabody, just doing like a historical survey of Peabody, out in the woods looking for whatever cellar holes and stone walls or whatever the usual thing. And they found this giant boulder. Again, we come back to giant boulders in New England. And this giant boulder that was painted with occult symbols, which the paint was faded. It was not recent paint. And it had sort of like an upside-down pentagram and sort of like maybe a symbol, I think, for sulfur and maybe the Episcopal cross. So some of these other symbols on there on this rock. And the archaeologists were like, what is this giant rock covered in occult symbols in the middle of the woods? They tested the paint to see what it was, and it was not commercial paint. It was made with like egg albumen and some ground up minerals. So someone had clearly made the paint themselves. So the archaeologists had a few suggestions of what this rock was. They thought maybe it was, the symbols could have been painted there, you know, in the 1600s during the Salem witch trials as a way to ward off witches. The area near where the boulder was found used to belong to a man named John Proctor, who was accused and executed during the Salem witch trials. So that they were thinking maybe these symbols were for that reason. Mm-hmm. You don't really see those symbols being used, though, in the Puritan era in New England. They were not painting upside-down pentagrams. It was not really their thing.
Yeah.
So another theory was maybe they were painted in 1892 when there was sort of bicentennial commemorations of the Salem trials. So someone might have done it then. Mm-hmm. That was another thought. And the last theory is it was just perhaps, some local Satanists in the 60s or 70s who did it and just had seen these symbols in a book like Anton LaVey's Satanic Bible or something like that.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is that the paint was not from the store. Yeah. So it wasn't like if someone did it, they went through enough trouble to make their own paint.
Yeah, that's an intriguing detail, that, isn't it?
Right. I mean, if I were just your average Satanist, I would just go to the store and buy some latex paints, right?
Yeah.
Black paint is black paint. But someone actually went to the effort of making this special paint. So it's interesting. And there is another rock, also called Witch Rock, down in Rochester, Massachusetts. And this one has been known as Witch Rock for quite a while, certainly since the 19th century. It was mentioned in some magazines in the 19th century as being like a rustic-looking, charming boulder to go visit if you go to Rochester, Massachusetts. And there are at least five legends or five theories explaining why it's called Witch Rock. And the first one is that when the Puritans came here, they saw the local Native Americans celebrating religious rituals near this rock. And since they're Puritans, they thought anything that was not, fundamentalist Protestant Christianity was evil. So they thought, we're going to call this Witch Rock, right?
Yeah.
That's one theory. The second theory is that the Puritans came. They saw the Native Americans avoiding the rock for some reason. And because of that, they call it Witch Rock, because there must be something unusual about that rock because people are avoiding it, so we're calling it Witch Rock.
Yeah.
Some people say that the soul of an evil witch is trapped inside the rock along with some demons, and they try to escape at night, and maybe you'll see like steam coming out of the cracks of the rock and hear some howling. That's, I think, theory three. The opposite theory is theory four, that a woman who was innocent of witchcraft was executed by the rock and her ghost haunts it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final theory is that one of the founders of the town fled from the Salem witch trials because he had been tapped to be a juror. He didn't want to send innocent people to the gallows, so he fled south to what is now Rochester, and he camped out next to this giant rock, and that's why it's called Witch Rock. Hmm. So you have five different theories about why the rock is called Witch Rock.
Mm-hmm.
Why, but it's interesting that this rock has attracted so much attention.
Yeah.
And someone even has painted a witch on it and written Witch Rock, so in case you're in Rochester, you'll know that this is Witch Rock. Like, here it is. I think people get together near at Halloween and things like that.
Yeah. And what about Witch's Woods in Beverly?
Oh, yeah. Witch's Woods in Beverly is an interesting place. It doesn't quite exist anymore. But back in the 1900s, Beverly, Massachusetts was a very rural town. It's north of Salem. And actually, people from Salem would go to Beverly on vacation. Right. If you're wealthy and you lived in Salem, maybe you would have like a summer house in Beverly to get out of the congestion of Salem.
Right.
And so a woman, a wealthy Salem woman named Carolyn King Howard, wrote her memoirs, and she tells a story about Witch's Woods. Her and her family would vacation in Beverly, and they had a house on the water. Nearby was a tract of land called Witch's Woods. And supposedly there are various spooky things associated with Witch's Woods. For example, there was a headless ghost who would wander around at night. There actually was a woman in the neighborhood that people said was a witch, and they would give her eggs and cheese and things like that to try to buy her good favor to kind of keep the witch away from them. But the most interesting thing about Witch's Woods is that there was supposed to be a haunted farmhouse in there. And it was called, I think, the Homestead was what it was called. And if you saw the Homestead, you knew you had reached the heart of Witch's Woods and that you were possibly in trouble. So this young woman, Carolyn King Howard, and her younger sister and their maid go for a walk one day in the woods. And they're walking in Witch's Woods. So they're kind of wandering around, and they get lost, which is puzzling to them since they haven't really walked that far from their house. They've walked maybe 15 minutes, and suddenly they can't figure out where they are. And they're wandering around. They're feeling a little distressed because they're stuck in the woods. No one has cell phones back then. They're just kind of they're going to have to find their own way out. And they suddenly come upon these ruins in the woods. And they find, like, the foundation of a house and has a big stone step. And there's a gigantic lilac bush growing there, like a huge lilac bush that has been there for decades and decades and decades. Mm-hmm. And Carolyn King Howard thinks to herself, oh, this is the homestead. Like, we have found the homestead, which is a little spooky. But they look around. There's nothing unusual there. So there's a nearby hill. They walk up to the top of the hill. And when they look back where they came from, they see a house that's, you know, not decaying, but in good shape, with smoke coming out of the chimney, with glass in the windows. It's got a big stone step, has a very small lilac bush growing next to it. And they see a woman come out of the house, and she sort of is throwing chicken feed to this flock of chickens that's outside the house. And the maid who's with them thinks, oh, you know, this must be a house nearby, right? This must be a house nearby. I'm going to go down and ask the woman for directions back to the beach so we can get back to our house. The maid, you know, runs back down the hill to the house. And the Carolyn King Howard and her sister wait for her to come back. And when the maid comes back, she says, you know, I went back down. I couldn't find the house. All I found were the ruins with the giant lilac bush and the big stone step. But I couldn't find the house itself. And so then they're really freaked out by that point. And they kind of rush off away from that area. And luckily they find a stream, and they follow the stream, which leads to the beach, and they're able to find their way back home. And so that's the story, which is good. It's creepy. Like, what happens? I don't know. Like, you don't want to go into that house that you see, because who knows if you just disappear or something like that. It's a creepy story, I think.
How old is that tale then?
That is probably from before the Civil War, I think. So probably the 1850s is my bet.
Right, that is old, yes. Because, I mean, that plot line comes up in a number of horror stories and horror movies and things. People stumbling across an inn or castle or something and interacting with the people who live there. And then when they return to the, if you like, their normal lives, it's been in ruins for centuries or whatever. Yeah.
Right. It's a friend of the family, a friend of the King family. I want to say his name was James Russell Lowell, who was like a magazine writer. He took the story from Carolyn King Howard and published it a couple places. And he went into the woods to try to find the homestead himself, but he could not find it. Well, he did take the story and publish it. So it may have been known also. But I think it's also like a common trope, right? A common paranormal or occult trope, right?
Yeah.
That the
yeah.
thing that you think is pleasant, once you have the clear vision, you realize it's not. It's almost like those fairy stories where someone's taken to the beautiful golden palace to nurse the queen's baby, and you rub the ointment in your eye by mistake, and suddenly you realize you're in a filthy cave suckling a little imp or something like that. You're like, oh hey, this is not what I thought.
Yes. Yeah. What about places you've visited there? Creepy sites either?
Creepy sites.
Ghosts or just places that make the hairs on the back of your neck stand up?
There are a lot. There are quite a few. And like I said earlier, I generally am someone who goes during the daytime. So I'm skeptical but cautious. There's a nice place in Lynn, Massachusetts, called Dungeon Rock. Again, it's a giant rock. And it was, for many years, people in Lynn, I think going back to like 1600s or perhaps just a little later, people in Lynn said that there was a pirate's treasure buried underneath Dungeon Rock. A man named Thomas Veal, who was a pirate, had come ashore in Lynn, and he supposedly had set up his household there, like a small hut or something in the woods. There was an earthquake, and the rock collapsed on him, and he was buried underneath it. And when I say a rock, it is like, it's like a hill, like it's a giant stone hill. Mm-hmm. And so supposedly Thomas Veal and his treasure is buried underneath this. In the middle of the 19th century, a spiritualist named Hiram Marble met with a psychic medium. And the psychic medium told him that she was in contact with the ghost of the pirate Thomas Veal. And Thomas Veal would guide Hiram Marble to find the buried treasure. And Hiram Marble just had to start digging. And so Hiram Marble, who was a very dedicated spiritualist, went up to Dungeon Rock and started to dig into it. And it's a solid rock.
Yeah.
So he had a pickaxe, and I don't know what else he had, but he started to dig and dig and dig. And so he would dig, and every now and then he would check in with the psychic, who would say, oh, you know, the pirate Thomas Veal says you should go a little further to the left. Or maybe you want to start going down now. And Hiram Marble did this for something like 15 years. Until he died. And then his son took over and did it maybe for like another 5 years. And they never found the treasure. I mean, I don't think you should listen to the ghost of a dead pirate. Even if you believe in ghosts, like why would a pirate be trustworthy? But a lot of local spiritualists helped fund his excavation. And for them, it was like a testament to the glories and power of spiritualism as an inspirational force. So if you go to Dungeon Rock today, there's a big iron door, mm-hmm. and it's open sometimes. The park ranger will open this door. And there's a tunnel that goes down into the earth like a corkscrew, something like 200 feet. Just down, 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 down into the darkness, and then it just stops. And that's what they dug. They dug this giant corkscrew tunnel for something like 20 years deep into the earth, and it's kind of spooky, like in various ways. Also, just thinking about the obsession that you would do that with. At a certain point, wouldn't you think this is not working out? But he never did. He's buried nearby somewhere. Hiram Marble is buried nearby somewhere near that rock as well. So it's good. It's like when I went, it was a hot August day. It was like 90 degrees Fahrenheit. When I got to the bottom of the tunnel, I could see my breath. It was so cold.
Yeah.
So it's pretty amazing that someone would do that. When people ask me about spooky places, one of my standard answers is that I went to the Ramtail Mill, mm-hmm. which is in Rhode Island, Foster, Rhode Island. And that mill was built in the 1700s by a small river by a wealthy man. And he hired a manager named Peleg Walker to manage it. Peleg Walker was the manager. And a small village arose around the mill where the workers lived, and everything was kind of prosperous and relatively happy. Mm-hmm. And everything, you know, went bad when Peleg Walker asked the owner of the mill if he could marry the owner's daughter.
Yeah.
And the owner was like, I don't think so. You know, I'm a rich mill owner. You're just my manager. Sorry. Like, that's a marriage down. That's not going to happen. So Peleg Walker rushes off, and he's very distressed. The next morning, the people in the village hear the bell ringing to summon them to work, because there's a bell that rings every morning in the mill that summons them to work. So all the workers go into the mill, and they're horrified to see that Peleg Walker has hung himself with the rope that hangs from the bell, and the bell is ringing because his body is swaying back and forth.
Right.
So everyone's like, wah! The owner cuts down the body and says, you know, don't pay any attention to this. Just go back to work. And they bury Peleg or whatever. So the people go back to work, you know, capitalism.
Yeah. Nothing to see here. Just move on.
Nothing to see here. Just keep making me money.
Yeah.
So the next morning, again, the bell rings. Everyone goes to the mill to go to work. And they're surprised to see that the rope from the bell is just ringing on its own. Like no one's pulling it. It's just ringing on its own.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, this is weird. And the owner's like, yeah, don't pay any attention to it. He cuts down the rope and says, everyone, go back to work. They go back to work. And then the next morning, you can see where this is going. The bell rings. Everyone goes to the mill. And there's no rope at all. But somehow the bell is still ringing. And ringing and ringing and ringing. And at that point, people realize that, you know, this mill is haunted. It's probably cursed. And they don't want to work there anymore. So people move away from the village. The river dries up and the mill becomes abandoned. And supposedly Peleg Walker's ghost was seen at different times, like with a lantern patrolling around and things like that. When we went, it's mostly sort of foundations, stone walls. There's some roads which are still there. We were the only people there, just the two of us. Mm-hmm. It was spooky, right? Yeah. Just being out in an environment like that on your own is just spooky in general, mm-hmm. Knowing the story behind it. And I took some photos of things with my iPhone, and a lot of them didn't come out. They just came out pure white, which
is also spooky.
Also spooky, right? Yes. That's spooky. Like, how does that happen with an iPhone? And so I was kind of creeped out. And we were there during the day, but I was like, wow, but this has never happened before. It only happened one other time a little bit when we went to an allegedly haunted cemetery, and not to the same extent.
Yeah.
So... And again, like, I'm a pretty skeptical person, but it was a spooky experience to have that happen.
Now, we're fast running out of time, and I'm conscious you are in your lunch break. So what are the melon heads of Connecticut?
Oh, yeah. The melon heads of Connecticut, they are these small little humanoids mm-hmm. that live in the woods, particularly around Fairfield County, Connecticut. And they're associated with certain rural roads in the towns in Fairfield, Connecticut. In particular, like, I think it's Velvet Road, which I want to say is in Sutton. I might get the town wrong, but a place called Velvet Road, which people nicknamed Dracula Drive. And so these melon heads are kind of small little humanoids. They have very spindly bodies. They have big, big heads. And they have, like, these glowing orange eyes. And... There's a great story where some teenage girls in the 1980s go to Dracula Drive in a big sedan. The girls all pile and they go to the sedan. They want to see a melon head, right? They want to have like that spooky mm-hmm. legend tripping experience. So they go out to Dracula Drive and they park the car and they're looking around and they don't see any melon heads. So they all get out of the car. And they kind of walk down the road a little cautiously, like looking in the woods, shining their flashlights, you know, calling out, melon heads, melon heads. And suddenly, behind them, the car engine starts and the car headlights come on. And the girls are kind of freaked out and they turn around and they can see behind the wheel of the car this spindly little humanoid with these big orange glowing eyes. And the car just revs up like the little melon head steps on the gas and kind of charges at the girls. The girls jump out of the way, and the car just drives off into the woods. And supposedly, some people say that if you are out in the woods at night down in that area, you may sometimes still see that car driving around with one or more melon heads inside the car, causing this trouble, right? Like a haunted car of melon heads. That's kind of the funny side. In the Yes. spookier side, the melon heads are sometimes blamed for disappearances. So, like, whether that's a pet or a hiker who gets lost in the woods and doesn't come back, the melon heads might be blamed for those sorts of things too. And they do have a tie. There are two explanations for where the melon heads come from. One is that there was an insane asylum in the area. It was abandoned or shut down by the state. And so the melon heads are sort of the descendants of
the inmates
who had no place else to go. They were just thrown out into the woods and they kind of became these melon heads. The other, which ties back into sort of the witchcraft history, is that there was a family in the area in the Puritan era who was accused of witchcraft, and they were exiled from the town that they lived in. They were kicked out. People said, we don't want witches in our town. Get out. So the family moved out into the woods, and they basically inbred with each other. Mm-hmm. And slowly devolved, if that actually happens, they slowly devolve into these melon head type beings. Yeah. And they're still there today. And there are more of them because of the inbreeding and things like that. So they live out in the woods and terrorize people and, you know, live off wild animals and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And again, you can maybe tie that into fairy lore. Like, are they a fairy? Maybe, maybe not. But they kind of fit the same category in some ways.
Yes, yes, of sort of possibly elemental creatures that are not one thing or the other. Well, I say, it's been a delight talking to you.
Thank you. This was great talking to you.
Hey, guys. News. The title is Shuckland, and it's a brand new book by Charles Christian. It takes you on a journey through the weird wonders and intriguing mysteries of the Waveney Valley. Explore with Charles the truth behind the notorious black shuck of the book's title. Be transported to a world of demonic entities, murderous earls, ley lines, witchcraft, paganism, and discover the facts behind the outrageous legends and folklore of this seemingly peaceful corner of England. Shuckland is a 200-page illustrated paperback available through bookshops and online via Amazon and Books Etc., as well as the Urban Fantasist website at www.urbanfantasist.com. Shuckland is priced at $12.95, and there's an ebook version available on Amazon priced just £3.25. Shuckland, get yours today.
And a big thank you to this week's guest, Peter Muse. That's Muse spelled M-U-I-S-E. You can find his books on Amazon and follow his blog at newenglandfolklore.blogspot.com. Now it just remains for me to say, this is Charles Christian saying thank you so much for listening in. Please join me again next week for more strange tales for strange times. Until then, stay well, stay weird. Goodbye.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon. Which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, folklore, and the paranormal. You can keep in touch with us online at www.urbanfantasist.com. By email to urbanfantasist@icloud.com and on Twitter @urbanfantasist. Join us again next week for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Goodbye.